So by the time I get the visa, I don't have enough money for a plane ticket. No, don't think about staying, living in America, just a plane ticket to get there. My parents had to take a bank loan to get me a plane ticket. I remember my mom crying and saying, "What are you going to do? You don't even have money to for day one." I landed at the Atlanta airport on July 27, 1999. I had less than $1 in my pocket. Less than $1. And one of the things that I remember so vividly is my girlfriend was in college. Remember that? So she
Right,
didn't have
right.
a job. She didn't have a job. She worked at the library in school, right? But she came and picked me up at the airport in Atlanta. And I remember we went past the gas station. And that day, gas was 97 cents. And I remember thinking to myself, I can't even afford a gallon of gas today. Yeah, remember that was July 27, 1999. Nothing. Rock bottom. And I'll then go to school. The first thing I did when I went to school was go and negotiate and say, "Hey, listen, I'm here, but I don't have your money to get started." I'll never forget the dean put his head down like this. He was like, "I cannot believe this." And he was like, "There's nothing we can do for you." And I walked away. And 2 days later, he called me. And when he called me, I thought I was going to get deported. So when he called me, he said to me, "Listen, this is what we're going to do for you. We have done some paperwork for you. All we can offer you is 30 hours of work study." Right. And so that 30 hours of work study is the one that paid for my tuition in school.
Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. Today, I have a very special guest, Innocent Hadibi. Innocent is the Director of Business Excellence at Chick-fil-A Corporate. I met Innocent as I meet many people on LinkedIn. We had many conversations, and I'm sure that you're going to find his story incredibly inspiring. You will hang on every word, and you'll be left wondering, man, if he can do it from where he came, why can't other people do it? Why can't I do it from where I am today? All we need is laser focus and dedication and perseverance. You will hear about his trials and tribulations, decisions he's made, some of them heart-wrenching, some of them bold and decisive, some of them based more on hope than logic. But you'll love his story, and I encourage you to share it with whomever you think would gain from the wisdom contained in his story. Hello, Innocent, and welcome to my podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a real great pleasure. You know, we've been connected on LinkedIn for quite some time. And then I guess it was October of 2022, you were a speaker at an Operational Excellence conference in Orlando.
And we in got Orlando, to, yes.
Yeah, to meet face-to-face for the first time. That was outstanding, and you gave a great talk. So so thanks for that. It was great to finally meet you face-to-face. But you've got a heck of a story, don't you?
I do. Yeah. We'll jump into it at some point today. So yes.
Yeah, I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it. You know, it was, you know, speaking with you, I could tell by your accent, you weren't from the States.
That gave it away that quick, huh? Yes, I'm originally from Zimbabwe.
Yeah, Zimbabwe. And that wasn't my first guess. Yeah, because there's so many people from Nigeria that come to the States that, and of course, South Africa that I didn't, Zimbabwe would not have been on my top two or three guesses of countries, but I had the opportunity to visit Zimbabwe in January. I guess it was January of 2023. I had always wanted to go, and I had the opportunity to tick off a visit to Victoria Falls, which was on
what an amazing place, huh?
Oh my gosh, it was. You know what? Most waterfalls I've ever seen, they come off of a cliff into an abyss, but at the bottom of the abyss is where the ground is at the new level.
That's right.
Okay. But Victoria Falls seems to fall into a gouge in the earth. You know, on both sides of the waterfalls, it's basically the same height. And it just seems to fall into like I said, a gouge, you know, an abyss. And it follows its own path at its own level. And I thought that was just really amazing. And it's very, very narrow compared to what you might think it might be.
I don't know if you had the opportunity to go across and witness the Devil's Pool. That's the little pool right next to the falls where you can actually be right at the edge.
Yeah, there was a point where a short answer to your question is, I saw the Devil's Whirlpool. What'd you call it? Devil's what?
The Devil's Pool.
The Devil's Pool. And that's where it takes a sharp right turn.
That's right.
And then it travels for a while straight, and then it makes almost like a 180 degree turn. I was sitting at this restaurant overlooking that turn, and I actually thought when I was looking at it that it was actually two rivers converging and then carrying on, but it actually did a complete 180, and it was just remarkable.
Awesome! I actually did some bungee jumping over there. As a matter of fact, I'll be doing it next week in about 16 days.
Down in Zim? You're going back to Zim?
I'm going back to Zim on the 20th.
Ah, awesome. Awesome. How long are you going to be there?
I'll be there for 11 days.
Oh, that's great. That's great. How are you flying out of? You're in Atlanta. So what are you taking? A Delta flight out to?
You know, from Atlanta, you have to take Delta, right?
Right.
So I'm a Delta guy. You got to get those sky miles. And then when I get to South Africa, I use a flight called SkyLink. That's a 45-minute flight from Joburg to Bulawayo.
Yeah, that's the one I took. Also, of course, to get there, I took Lufthansa because I'm coming out of Frankfurt.
Right.
But, that's a long flight, isn't it?
16 hours.
You know, the first time I took that flight, it was out of JFK. It was JFK to Joburg. And the first time I took that flight, it was like you said, 16 hours. And the only thing I could say about that flight is that every other flight you'll ever take for the rest of your life is easy.
That's right. So it's that flight and the flight to Beijing, they are almost the same. 16 straight hours sitting on that flight.
That's rough.
So you can do a lot of reading though. That's good.
You can, that's absolutely right. So, you've been in the States for some time. So how does a person get from Bulawayo, in Zim, to Chick-fil-A in Atlanta?
Oh my goodness. I'm going to try to be as succinct as possible here. And I'm going to move like in big blocks of time, for the sake of time. But, so the dream to actually come to America is a dream that, I was 9 years old. I was in the third grade. A friend of the family, my uncle's friend, went to study in the United Kingdom. And so he came back in 1983. On vacation, and he was showing us some pictures of his college that he was going to. And as a 9 year old, I was just so fascinated and asking all these questions. And right then, and I told my parents, I said, hey, at the time it was, I'm going to go and study in Britain, just like Uncle Larry. And, my mom was my first supporter on that day. And I'll never forget. She was like, my baby's going to study engineering in England. But fast forward that 4 or 5 years later, when I was a freshman in high school, that's when the rubber met the road. I went to Milton High School. It's a boys only high school. It was a huge school, over 1,800 boys. And the freshman class was over 500 boys. And we were being asked, we're learning like the school hymns, and we were being asked the regular questions that you're asked as a high schooler, like, hey, what's your name? What class you're in? What do you want to do when you grow up? Everybody else got up and said, hey, I want to be a doctor. I want to be a businessman. I want to be a teacher. I want to be an architect. And Innocent gets up and says, when I grow up, I'm going to live in the first world. I'm going to live in the United Kingdom or in the United States. And the whole auditorium went quiet. And our teacher started asking me like all of these probing questions, like, how are you going to do that? Who do you know over there? I did not have an answer for any one of his questions. He made me feel so small that day. I'll never forget that, because from that day on, it set the tone for my high school life. Anybody who wanted to get a crack, a laugh, will come to me and say, hey, so what's going to happen when you're 30 years old? Where are you going to be? And at some point, I became so arrogant about it. And I was like, hey, I will be in the United Kingdom or the United States. I'm going to send you a postcard one day. So I graduated high school. Yeah. I graduate high school, I start an apprenticeship program. So I moved from 500 plus guys to 25 guys. And on our first week, they ask us, what are your plans? What are your expectations? What do you want to gain out of this program? Out of 25 guys, I get up again. I say, hey, my aspirations, and now I was very, very succinct. My aspirations are to go to the United States, study engineering, and I don't even think I'm going to finish this program. That's how I said it. And everybody else started laughing. And there was a guy from my high school who was 2 years ahead of me. So he was a third year while I was the first year. And his words were, that fool has been saying that since high school. So the apprenticeship program is 4 years long. And so God is amazing, man, because in the 4 years, my girlfriend had heard this story, like, hey, I want to go to the United States. I want to go to the United States. And as a second year, she gets accepted at a college in Milledgeville, Georgia. And so when she gets accepted at the college in Milledgeville, Georgia, she says to me, this is your chance. But you got to remember, I do not come from a rich family. I come from a very modest family. We did well. We did okay with the standards of Zimbabwe. But when you compare it here, my mom was a teacher, right? So we didn't have a lot. So I knew I couldn't even afford a plane ticket, let alone tuition at a university in the United States. But we started the process to start to apply to schools. We found the cheapest school that I could find, but I could not afford the cheapest school. And that was Macon Technical College out of Middle Georgia. And I did get accepted at the school. And while I was in the process of getting accepted, I had an opportunity to work as a journeyman 6 months before I graduated. A friend of mine brokered a deal with his uncle from another mine. And we were supposed to go and do this mock interview, but the job was actually ours. So what had happened was, my girlfriend, we didn't have cell phones, mind you. This is 1998, we don't have cell phones. We are writing each other letters and making appointments that, hey, I'm gonna call you on this day, like 2-3 weeks away. I'll call you on this day at this time. Go and wait for your phone call at a phone booth, not at somebody else's phone, at a phone booth, right? And so that day, I was supposed to receive a phone call from her giving me information about my application. But the interview was 400 miles away. I had to make a decision. Do I go to the interview? Do I wait for the phone call? I chose the phone call, right? But at that time, it felt like I had made the biggest mistake, because the satisfaction of choosing the phone call, the results were not right there. The results that were instant was me going 400 miles and getting this interview and getting this job. So when the two gentlemen came and they had been offered jobs and the jobs that they were offered, they were going to get paid more than 10 times what we made as apprentices. And I will never forget the bus ride when they came back from that, and they're so happy. Everybody's happy for them. And the gentleman said, hey, it was supposed to be three of us. And the other one was like, so who's the third one? And he said, that clown. Those were his words. He said, that clown was supposed to join us, but he had a phone call from America, so he did not go. And everybody threw their hands up. They're like, come on, man. You knew about this guy. He's not going to do anything. He has this pipe dream about going to America. That is the first time, Joseph, that I started to doubt my decision making. Because at that very moment, there was a reality of my friends just got accepted as journeymen. Yes, I just got this phone call that I got accepted at this school, but the gratification at the moment was I could have gotten this. I could be a journeyman by now. I could be making more money. And everybody started clowning me. Maybe the worst 6 months of my training as an apprentice, because there were guys that would like talk about it every single day, talking about, I cannot believe you chose this guy. I cannot believe you went with him. Look now, there's a gap. One of us could have gotten in there and all of that. And the worst day was the day we graduated, because when we graduated, I wasn't even offered a job by the company. So now I don't have a job. I'm not going to the States. I missed out on the opportunity, and everybody looking at me like this loser. But the process was taking place underneath. Things were moving. They were not moving fast, but something was happening. And so I started going to try to get my visa. I was denied the visa six times. Six times I went there, they denied me the visa. And I'll never forget, on that sixth time, the same group of guys came to me and did an intervention and set me down and said, hey, this America thing, nobody's going to blame you if you give up. You put your best foot forward. You did your best. Hey, it wasn't meant to be. You just give it up. And I would not relent. And when I went for the seventh time, I went on a Monday, and they told me, you will get the visa. Come and collect the visa on Thursday. So because I was so excited but scared at the same time, I didn't tell anybody. I came back on Tuesday, drove back on Wednesday evening, Thursday morning, I picked up that visa. And when I picked up that visa, I went back and I started packing my clothes. Because I had a 2 week window between the day I got the visa and the day I was leaving. So everybody came and I was packing my clothes. I told one guy and he ran around the whole compound telling everybody. And everybody started helping me pack. Now the tune has changed, right? Now everybody's like, I knew it. I knew it. You had it in you. You had it, right? Yeah, but this is the kicker, though. I had saved enough money at the time, because now I'm a journeyman. I've been a journeyman for a year when I get the visa. But I've spent a lot of money traveling to try to get the visa. And every time you apply for the visa, you're paying a lot of money to do that, and you get denied. So by the time I get the visa, I don't have enough money for a plane ticket. No, don't think about staying, living in America, just a plane ticket to get there. My parents had to take a bank loan to get me a plane ticket. I remember my mom crying and saying, what are you going to do? You don't even have money for day one. I landed at the Atlanta airport on July 27, 1999. I had less than $1 in my pocket. Less than $1. And one of the things that I remember so vividly is my girlfriend was in college. Remember that? So she didn't have a job. She didn't have a job. She worked at the library in school, right? But she came and picked me up at the airport in Atlanta. And I remember we went past the gas station, and that day, gas was 97 cents. And I remember thinking to myself, I can't even afford a gallon of gas today. Yeah, remember, that was July 27, 1999. Nothing. Rock bottom. And I'll then go to school. The first thing I did when I went to school was go and negotiate and say, hey, listen, I'm here, but I don't have your money to get started. I'll never forget the dean put his head down like this. He was like, I cannot believe this. And he was like, there's nothing we can do for you. And I walked away. And 2 days later, he called me. And when he called me, I thought I was going to get deported. So when he called me, he said to me, listen, this is what we're going to do for you. We have done some paperwork for you. All we can offer you is 30 hours of work study, right? And so that 30 hours of work study is the one that paid for my tuition in school. So I, at what I was studying at the time, it was automated manufacturing. I was doing robotics and all of that. So I did like a 2-year associate's degree. And then I was fortunate enough, while I was studying that, I then got a scholarship to go and study industrial engineering at Bluffton University in Ohio. So that's where I studied industrial engineering and organizational management. And then I went on to study an MBA with a focus in operations. So while I was there, that's when I then got recruited by an aerospace company called Goodrich Aircraft Wheels and Brakes. That's where I grew up in the corporate world. That's where I grew up in the operational excellence world, because they were so on point with their lean program, their Six Sigma program. When I first started as a young engineer, like literally ran almost 20 Kaizen events per year, right? If you were not running a Kaizen event, either you were closing on a Kaizen event or starting and preparing for another one. I did that for 3 years, and then I started to get elevated, becoming the CI guy in the building, and then becoming the CI guy across North America. Then obviously I left there and joined a company called TTI Floke, where I led operational excellence and process engineering for their North American division. They had 7 facilities, 2 of those were manufacturing and 5 of those were distribution centers. So I led that. And while I was there, I was recruited by Chick-fil-A. Right now at Chick-fil-A, I am the director of the Center of Business Excellence. And within that space, I am in charge of the engineering strategy, reporting and analytics, master data systems, and change management. So that's like in a nutshell, I just crammed in a good 24 years right there, just in a nutshell.
Well, I got to tell you, I can't believe that I didn't say anything throughout that entire sharing that you had. And it's just a remarkable journey. This is the second time I've heard it, okay, yes. In its entirety. I'm just dumbfounded for everything that you went through in order to get the seats that you've got today. And just, you know, just a constant uphill battle, and you just didn't give up. Now, just the Masters tournament was just this weekend. Well, you know that because it's in Georgia. Yes. and he had some weather there. But this guy by the name of Rahm won, you know, on the last day he pulled ahead. And he shared a tweet from when he was 13, and it showed a fortune cookie fortune. Mm-hmm. And it basically said, you'll achieve whatever it is that you want to achieve. And he said at that moment that he wants the green jacket at the Masters.
I like that.
Okay. And so here he is, you know, some years later, and he's got the green jacket. And it just, you know, reminds me of your story, except that your story doesn't start off at such an elevated level as Rahm's did. I mean, you know, I've been to Bulawayo. I took a picture of your high school, Milton High School.
Yes. What did you think? What did you think of that high school?
You know what? It was actually a pretty impressive high school. I was thinking that, and I was expecting it to be a lot more dilapidated than it was. I mean, they had the school bus out front. You know, the grounds weren't kept up, but I can't compare that to when you were there. You know, but you know, it was an impressive high school. Just the size of it. And, you know, you explaining how many students were there, you know, your class was what, 500, I think you said.
Yeah. Per class.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's but to go from there. Okay. And as you say, Zimbabwe is not the richest country in the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And especially in the late 1990s, I have when I was there, I bought a note, a 20 billion Zim dollar note. Okay.
I got one of them on the other side of the room.
You know, you look at this and it just looks ridiculous with all those zeros. I mean, it just looks ridiculous.
Too many zeros,
And I bought that and another, you know, 5 billion Zim dollar note and a couple of other, you know, 50 million Zim dollar notes. And all of these, you know, I probably got like, you know, I don't even know how many billions of dollars in notes. I got them all for $3, right?
That's right.
You know, so from somebody that wanted to sell them to me. But you think about this. You think about, you know, not only did you have to overcome the challenges of logistics and everything. I mean, you know, it's a poor country. And even if you're well-to-do, you're not that well-to-do. I mean, by Western standards, you think about that starting point and all the resistance and all the naysayers that you had to encounter along the way. You know what I mean? And you just kept focused. You just kept focused on the prize. And I mean, you didn't, you know, Rahm started at, you know, in Spain. So his starting point was a lot more advanced than your starting point.
Right.
And I got to tell you, you've got the, you know, and forgive my saying it this way, you've got the biggest stones of anybody I've ever met. Okay. I mean, you know, coming to America, you didn't have enough money to buy a gallon of gas. You had nothing. When you got here, when you finally got here, you had nothing. And going to the school and saying, I'm here, but I can't pay you anything. It's just like, and people helped you along the way. And I think that's, especially once you got to the States, it didn't sound like you had a whole lot of support in Zimbabwe, except for your parents, of course, your mom's in particular. But once you got here, it seemed like you found a support network that looked after you a little bit. So I got to ask, have you kept in touch with these people that helped you along the way once you got here?
I did. I do. It's people that I met at church, the church that we went to. In particular, there was this couple that will take us out for number one. We couldn't afford dinner. We couldn't afford just literally going out. I can tell you like a story there. In the 2 years that I was at Macon Tech, I was only able to go to Applebee's twice. And those two times were like my girlfriend, who's my wife now, that was her birthday. Those are the two times we went to Applebee's because it was the night out. But still, when we did that, I would drink water because I'm on a budget. I'm afraid that if I pick a drink, maybe it will hike up the price. I did not know. So you sit there and you're just like counting your pennies and they tell you the price. You're looking at the price of the meal and all of that. But there was this couple that used to, on Sundays after church, they would invite us either to their home or they would invite us to go and have lunch with them. To a buffet. It was either Golden Corral or Ryan's Buffet, and we will. That's when we'll get like the steaks and all of that good stuff. But it wasn't just like them supporting us like that, but they also were there to encourage us, like it's going to be okay, right? And they were also like the voice of reason within our ears, that they were like, hey, listen, as you start this journey, it's not going to be easy, but you're in the right path, right? You might not have all the nice things. You might not have the money, but you are in school. You're doing the right things. You're taking the necessary steps. If you just stay focused, if you just stay the course. But with anything, when you are in a space like that, then you become vulnerable as well from people that are trying to take advantage of you. So case in point, there was a gentleman in college that came to me. He used to wear nice clothes, like nice chain. At the time, FUBU was the number one label. Kalkanai were like the labels. And I only saw those on TV. And he had that stuff, right? And so he came to me one day and said to me, hey, let me take you out to lunch. The very first time I ever went to a Subway restaurant, while I was being taken by this guy. And when we got to Subway, I then found out that his guy wanted me to be his mule. If you've seen that movie with Clint Eastwood, right, where he was the mule moving drugs from one point to the next. That's what he wanted me to be. He was like, hey, listen, you are an African. Everybody around here knows you as just like the African kid. Nobody suspects you. If you move this product from here to there, we'll pay you $500. And I'm sitting there, even the food that I'm eating, I didn't know what to order. He ordered for me because it was my first time at Subway. And my first meal at Subway was that meatball sandwich. And I told him no. Right then and there, I was like, I'm not going to do that. My parents worked so hard for me to get here. I put in a lot of work and sacrifice and sweat and blood to get here for me to start doing these things. And then I said to me, God will provide. Because he said to me, look at you, right? You are wearing a Kmart t-shirt for $3. I was wearing a golf shirt from Kmart. And I bought it for $3.99, and I was proud of it. It's, hey, that's the best I could do at the time. And he was like, look at you, look at what you're wearing. And then when I said, no, God will provide, he said to me, right now, between me and you, who looks like they know God? And he did like this. He said, who looks like they know God? And so he drove me back to school. He never talked to me again. And I never saw him for a while. So I moved from Georgia. I go to Ohio. I get married. I got kids. We're going to Florida. I run into the guy.
Wow.
He's working at McDonald's. And as I pull up to pick up my order, I'd forgotten him. Because he had like beard and all of that. And he says, I know you. And when he said that, I remembered him. And I'm like, what are you doing here? He was like, man, what had happened was. And then started telling me all the story, how he ended up going to prison and all of that. And so when we pulled off, I told my wife, I said, that's the guy that told me he knew God. So we've had people that have been really supporters and helped us, mentored us and coached us. But also we also had people that tried to take advantage of us because of the situation that we're in. And thankfully, we made the right decisions, because I think the people that were doing the mentoring and coaching, they really stayed on us and made sure that we stay on the clear path.
Right. Well, you seem to be a pretty focused individual anyway. Now, your wife,
yes.
Is she the one that came to the States before you?
Yes, she's the one that came to the States before
So
me.
She was your girlfriend back in Zim, right?
She was my girlfriend back in Zim, yes.
Remarkable. That's a remarkable story. Now,
she is truly my better half.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, you're a pretty good half yourself. So if he's better, that's saying something. So I want to cover another thing that you're doing. You have this project or this I want to call it an NGO, but it's not really a it's to help villagers in Zim, right?
Yes,
having to do with building wells or something right. like that. Mm-hmm. So yes. Tell me about that. What's the name of the organization?
So the name of the organization is called the Lot Water Project. So LOT Water Project, right? And the name Lot, that's my grandfather's name. And the reason why I used his name is he was a remarkable man. He's the man that brought our family to Christ. He's the man that led the family. I'm the way you see me today is everything that he poured into me as a man, how I show up, how I stand up, right? How I reflect my family. It's a true reflection of him. So the Lot Water Project, that is my purpose in life right there, Joseph. Coming to America and starting to gain success, you start to ask yourself, like, why did God bring me to this blessing? I know he didn't just bring me so that I and my family have a good life. That it has to be bigger than that. And it's something that I have been asking myself for a long time. And January 1st, 2020, when everybody else was doing New Year's resolutions about, hey, I'm going to lose 10 pounds. I'm going to exercise more. I said, I wanted to know what my purpose is in this life. And I got with a group of people, just asked everybody, I need you guys to pray with me and understand, like, what is my true purpose? Why am I in this world? And showing up 6 months later, July 14, 2020, the village that I grew up in, 13 people die. Because of COVID? Bad water. No, because of bad water. Yeah.
Okay.
And then thousands are hospitalized. It's in the newspaper. It's in the internet for all of us that are in the diaspora. And one guy from our area where we grew up, that's a GoFundMe in the United Kingdom. I donate to that. But something in me keeps saying, you need to be part of the solution. And in exactly 2 weeks, I started a GoFundMe. I'd already done the research on how much I needed to drill a solar-powered borehole or water well. And it was $16,700 that was needed at the time. I was able to raise that kind of money in 21 days. And so when we did that, I'm excited. We got ourselves a well. And then somebody comes to me and says, Innocent, is that enough? Are you going to be a one and done? Right. And then I started to realize that, yes, we did drill a well, but now I got somebody who lives 6 miles away one way who's walking to this well and walking another 6 miles back. And so a friend of mine came to me and said, I need you to start a nonprofit. I know you want to, but you don't have the money. Here's $5,000. This is not to drill a well, but this is for you to find a lawyer to start a 501c3. So I did that. By October of that year, we were a registered 501c3. And since then, we have 6 wells that we have drilled. Two of them are in the community. 4 of them, they're in schools, because now we have started to focus on drilling in schools so that kids do not have to go 3 miles before they go to class to go fetch water and go another 3 miles after school. So now they have water in the schoolyard. So right now we have 4 wells in schools. We just like literally purchased our own drilling rig, which is going to cut the cost of the production and everything by 46%. So that will also then speed up the number of wells that we are going to push. So we pushed 6 wells in 2 years. We're going to push 6 wells in 4 months, right? That's the speed that we're going to be going in. That's the reason why I'm going to Zimbabwe in 2 weeks to go and commission our drilling rig so that we start drilling all of these wells across the schools in Bulawayo. And the plan is we want to go beyond all the other rural areas and deep into the country, but we want to cover as many schools as we possibly can.
That's amazing. That's an amazing story. That is a simply amazing story. So for those of you that don't know, 501(c)(3), or is it C3?
C3, yes.
C3, 501(c)(3) yes. Is a registered with the IRS not-for-profit organization.
That's correct.
And of course, separately from this recording, you'll send me all the information for, you know, whatever GoFundMe and websites, yes, and everything else, so I could attach, yeah, it to the end of this this broadcast. That would be
super. I'll definitely do that. Yes.
Okay. Super. Yes. Super. I got to tell you, this is an incredible story, and it's probably the single most incredible story I've ever heard live. You know what I mean? Like actually from another person that I knew and their journey.
That's humbling.
In my entire life. I can't think of anything that would be remotely similar. So, well, excellent, Innocent. Well, thanks for joining me today and sharing your journey. I'm sure that everybody will find it as fascinating as I did. And they will be remarking that I kept quiet most of the time because I was just so fixated on your story. So I appreciate your joining me a great deal, and I hope to see you at the next OPEX conference in October. Incredibly beautiful country, Zimbabwe. Incredibly beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I can't wait to go back. So thanks again for joining me today, Innocent. It was a great pleasure having you.
No, thank you for having me, and I just appreciate you just taking the time to listen to my story. I truly, truly appreciate this. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at josephparis.me/card. That was a really, really great session. Thanks for sharing. I mean, it was probably one of the best interviews I've ever had on the show. The story is so rich and so wonderful and inspiring. So really, I appreciate it a great deal.
No, I appreciate you just like giving me the forum because, I mean, here we are. I wouldn't have gotten this chance if me and you had not connected. So yeah. I just want from the bottom of my heart, like to thank you just for what you've done for me this far, right? I think at some point you're going to be woven in my story. I'm serious because as I get, you know, visibility and all of that, We're going to look back and saying, where did this all start? And your name is going to come into the people that gave me a shot, the people that gave me visibility, people that gave me a chance. And that's one thing that I've learned in life. You had asked me like some of the phrases that are near and dear to my heart was, one of the ones that I gave you was relationships endure. Right. Because I know what it means. Like to you, it might be very little, like, oh, I'm talking to Innocent, I'm helping Innocent. But to me, it's a huge, huge deal to be on your podcast. Who knows who's going to listen to this? Who knows who's going to help the Lord Water Project? So truly, truly appreciate this because God knows. Wherever we go, now your name is going to be woven in my story as to how I get to, when somebody asks me, how did you get here? Then this, you are in the path of the things and the people that have helped direct my life. So I'm thankful for that.
Thanks for that. That's humbling, to say the very least. I don't know if you noticed behind me, this is actually a virtual background, but it's a picture of what's in my front. So all of those artifacts that you see there are actually in front of me because I took a picture and I made it in back of me.
I like that. I like that. I'm a soccer guy, so that's why you see my
I see that. Yeah.